You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of July 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
the decision to go to war in Iraq and to remove Saddam Hussein from power in a coalition of over 40 countries led by the United States of America was the hardest, most momentous, most agonizing decision I took in my 10 years as British Prime Minister. For that decision today, I accept full responsibility.
We have concluded that the UK chose to join the invasion of Iraq before the peaceful options for disarmament had been exhausted. Military action at that time was not a last resort.
Sir John Chilcot finally delivers his epic report into Britain's conduct of the Iraq War. Tony Blair swiftly replies with a hardly less monumental rebuttal. My guests Rosemary Hollis and William Patey will be here for a special programme reflecting on Chilcot, what it tells us that we didn't know and what it suggests we should have known before embarking on such a colossal enterprise. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And you are welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Rosemary Hollis, Professor of International Politics at City University London, and William Patey, former British Ambassador to Iraq, as well as Sudan, Saudi Arabia and Afghanistan, also an International Affairs Advisor at Control Risks. Welcome both. Now, it has been 7 years in the making. It's 2.6 million words, fill 12 hefty volumes, and it has been published through happenstance amidst the worst and most bizarre political turmoil in recent British history. And yet, Sir John Chilcot's long and long-awaited report into the 2003 Iraq War has riveted attention in Britain, much as the consequences of the conflict have affected Britain ever since. William, first of all, you spent quite a while in Baghdad seeing the more or less immediate aftermath of the invasion up close. Has Chilcot, and I'm not going to test you on all 2.6 million words, but as far as it's possible to tell so far, has Chilcot told you anything you didn't already know?
Well, I've read the 200-page executive summary, but
good work.
I think, in a way, no, but to have it all explained in such detail and laid out is very interesting. I don't think that anybody who had a view on Iraq is going to be told anything new. I think the fact that there is no there's no smoking gun, that there was legal advice saying it was illegal, that we went to war knowing it was illegal, or that we went to war on a false premise. I think at the time there was a belief that there were some weapons of mass destruction. I think what Chilcot has said is that the degree of certainty applied to the assessments was unjustified, which I think is true, and that the key point was this was a war of choice, that all the peaceful options hadn't yet been exhausted, is also true. As somebody who supported the containment policy, I was head of Middle East Department in the run-up to the war, there were some options left. I have to say they were pretty weak. And there was not many people who believed that containment still had some life left in it. And certainly post 9/11, it was very difficult to engage American attention. But his essential conclusions, I think, are difficult to dispute.
I would say also that when he says all other options had been exhausted, by the stage of choosing to invade Iraq, the weapons inspection regime that Hans Blix was in charge of on the ground in Iraq hadn't finished its work. And so I think Chilcot could well, or the committee could well, have reached the conclusion that they didn't allow the steps put in place at the UN in autumn 2002 to run through to logical conclusion. And we all know, or those of us who were following the issue very closely at the time, know that this was because the Americans had mobilized for an invasion in the winter of 2002-03, and they didn't want to keep all their troops on the ground out in the Gulf and in in and around Iraq all the way through the summer of 2003 for an autumn invasion, by which time they might have got the French on board at the Security Council. So there was a timetable that Tony Blair was certainly aware of, and he, if he could, had to get a second UN resolution in time for a March invasion. And that's when he starts accelerating increasing the amount of pushing the legal case against the odds.
It's funny you mentioned that timetable there. It was something that actually hadn't occurred to me until I got to Baghdad in May 2003, and I was talking to an American tank crew who spoke about this, and I said, what do you mean? And he pointed at his big Abrams tank and said, this was built to fight the Russians in Europe. It doesn't have air conditioning. If we tried to do this in the summer, it would have been 70 degrees in that cockpit.
That's a perfect illustration. Exactly.
There was certainly military pressure to go in March for the reasons that Rosemary explains. But I think, in fairness, there would also have been a cynicism on the part of the Americans and ourselves that another 5 or 6 months of discussion would have led anywhere, given that we'd been having 18 months of attempts to get the Russians and the French to move to a smarter sanctions regime. So they would have calculated that this was a fruitless task.
Now, but you give a lot away when you say that, because technically we were allegedly all expecting weapons of mass destruction to be found. And the theory was in London in March 2003 that Saddam Hussein must be even cleverer than we thought in concealing such things.
Yeah, I think we did. Feel that he was concealing things. And what is interesting in the aftermath of finding out there weren't weapons of mass destruction on the scale that we thought might be there, is the lengths he went to convince us he had them. There was quite a lot of coming out from Saddam, and it may be that that's part of the tough guy of the Gulf image that he was trying to promote. Because we all thought, well, if he doesn't have them, why doesn't he just cooperate?
This has been quite a common theory that he was basically bluffing with a pair of twos and didn't expect anyone to call him,
or that his senior military officers and those people involved in the former weapons technology program didn't dare tell Saddam Hussein.
I've heard that one as well, this idea that he went, okay, launch, and they had to go, yeah, about that. But to move back to Chilcot, the thing that it does seem to come down hardest on is not so much the actual invasion of Iraq, which in terms, you know, whether you agreed with it or not, as a military enterprise went quite well quite quickly, but the aftermath, or rather the complete lack of planning thereof. I mean,
which should have preceded the invasion.
Of course it should. But William, as someone who was there having to deal with this and preparing to go there, at what point did it become clear to you that nobody seemed to have actually had this conversation about what do we do when we get there?
Well, I think there was a kind of assumption on the American part that all they had to do was go in, overthrow Saddam Hussein, and natural forces would be so happy.
This is bizarre magical thinking.
It was completely bizarre. But there was also a mentality that anyone who came up with an argument that would say how difficult it all would be, how complicated it would be, and the forces that would be unleashed might make it more difficult to justify going to war. There was that kind of sense, I had it as an official, that there wasn't much appetite for people who had a whole list of objections to why this might not be a good idea. And I think that was part of the problem. And the fact is that the Americans were the big players. I suppose we made an assumption that they had all these plans in hand. I was on another program with General Tim Cross, who was in the United States just prior to the invasion, and he was saying it was difficult to get into the American system, that the whole planning process was being done by the Pentagon and by Rumsfeld, who really believed this was going to be easy.
We will be speaking to General Cross on the Daily later tonight, coincidentally enough. But let's look now at the response of Tony Blair, which began unfurling earlier this afternoon, and for a while there seemed set fair to dwarf the report he was replying to. Rosemary, he's fallen back on this line before, that basically, say whatever else you will, he acted with the best of intentions. Is that good enough at this point?
It's absolutely not good enough. And if you have any kind of political judgment, it's not good enough to have a moral and ethical objective. You have to have worked out whether you can deliver on that objective, and it's political calculations that have to go into the delivery. In other words, you need all the institutional arrangements that deliver any policy to be geared up for what it is that you want to achieve. Otherwise, it's useless wanting to help the Iraqi people. You might end up doing the exact opposite, which is indeed what happened.
William, does he at least have a case when he says, and again, it's something he's fallen back on before, that he's being a bit battered by hindsight here, and that any reasonable person in the position he occupied with the intelligence he had in front of him could very well have made their way to the decision he made?
Well, he made some strategic calculations, which I think are entirely reasonable. He was prime minister, and he talked quite emotionally about the atmosphere after 9/11 and the number of people who had died and the sense of solidarity with the Americans. And he wouldn't be the first British Prime Minister to say that it is in Britain's national interest, strategic interest, to be close to and support the Americans. So that was framing his.
This is something Chilcot did pick him up on, though, sort of making the point that it hadn't really done the UK any harm to stay out of Vietnam, for example.
Yeah, and that's a fair enough point. I think the best decision that Harold Wilson ever made was not going with the Americans. I mean, there was some short-term pain. I think he got a lot of grief from Lyndon Johnson, but in the longer term, it didn't affect us.
The late Robin Cook, in his memoir, did say that Tony Blair wouldn't be in his wildest dreams to gainsay the Americans. He said Tony was hardwired to be captivated by the power of Washington. And if Washington said it was going to do something, then Tony's instinct was to help, not to say, not a good idea, don't think we should do that.
But that was a position taken by successive British Prime Ministers, so it's not unique to Tony Blair. And in fairness to him, I mean, I was there looking at the same intelligence that he was looking at. And I have to say, what you can criticise him for is where the intelligence was nuanced and uncertain and less specific. He took that and then in his leadership role to persuade the British people and British Parliament that we should go to war, he applied a degree of certainty that was unjustified. And I think Chilcot picks up on that I think we did genuinely believe there was a programme on weapons of mass destruction, but the certainty that was applied to the intelligence picture was unjustified, I think.
Again, Rosemary, this is another thing he fell back on at a couple of points during his epic extemporization this afternoon, that again, say whatever else you will, he wasn't actively, mendaciously lying. It may well be that, as William suggests, he was rather reading what he wanted to read into things, but he's claiming, or at least asserting, that Chilcot does actually clear him of, you know, actually lying.
It does, but I don't think you get to be Prime Minister and have successive...
It's a low bar to clear, certainly.
Well, indeed. I mean, you know, it doesn't make it all right that he didn't lie. The point is, you shouldn't be occupying an office like that if you haven't done everything to make sure that you have prevented gross failures of significant policy and taking seriously going to war. And what Sir William Patey said slightly earlier about it, there was a reluctance to hear from people who said it might be difficult in post-invasion Iraq, is very instructive, because one of the reasons why I, at the time at Chatham House, and my colleagues were presenting and publishing scenarios for how it could go after the invasion were not getting heard is clearly because we were pointing out it might be difficult.
I mean, just finally, before we move on off this subject, I'll ask you, William, does the Chilcot report, does it affect Tony Blair's legacy and standing, I guess? I mean, anybody who gets to his position in government has an eye on the history books. They want to be well thought of. Does this affect that in any way?
Well, I think it does. I think even before the Chilcot inquiry, Tony's legacy was going to be Iraq. He was always going to be remembered for Iraq, and seen as a failure. And I think Chilcot has just cemented that. I think Tony will always be remembered for that and nothing else.
I think the timing of the awful bombing in the centre of Baghdad this past weekend and the high casualties was extraordinary to coincide with the release of the Chilcot report. And it occurs to me that media coverage of the situation in Iraq has got progressively, over the last few years, more pessimistic about the validity of Tony Blair's arguments. That you know, at least it was a good thing to remove Saddam Hussein. I don't find anybody supporting that argument anymore.
But to blame Tony Blair for everything that's happened in Iraq is frankly ludicrous.
And Chilcot doesn't.
Yeah, he doesn't. But, I mean, a lot of people do. The Americans take, you know, most of the blame. And actually, I think the Iraqis get off a bit scot-free, having been in Iraq and been the frustrations. You know, okay, we broke it and we should have fixed it. But, you know, 10 years, 13 years on, I think the Iraqis need to take some responsibility.
We will come back to that later in the programme. For now, you're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Rosemary Hollis and William Patey. Still to come is the phrase, "I will be with you, whatever," likely to be Blair's political epitaph. Before that, though, here is Sir John Chilcot delivering some of his report's finding earlier today and some more of Tony Blair's reply.
We have concluded that the UK chose to join the invasion of Iraq before the peaceful options for disarmament had been exhausted. Military action at that time was not a last resort. We have also concluded that the judgments about the severity of the threat posed by Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, WMD, were presented with a certainty that was not justified. Despite explicit warnings, the consequences of the invasion were underestimated. The planning and preparations for Iraq after Saddam Hussein were wholly inadequate. The government failed to achieve its stated objectives.
It's claimed by some that by removing Saddam we caused the terrorism today in the Middle East, and that it would have been better to have left him in power. I profoundly disagree. Saddam was himself a wellspring of terror, a continuing threat to peace and to his own people. If he'd been left in power in 2003, then I believe he would once again have threatened world peace, and when the Arab revolutions of 2011 began, he would have clung to power with the same deadly consequences that we see in the carnage in Syria today. Whereas at least in Iraq, for all its challenges, we have today a government that is elected, is recognized as internationally legitimate, and is fighting terrorism with the support of the international community. The world was and is, in my judgment, a better place without Saddam Hussein.
Former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, before him Sir John Chilcot. Now, amid the 2.6 million words of Chilcot, the six that stand out most were written by Tony Blair. "I will be with you, whatever," introducing his 2002 memo to George W. Bush setting out the road to Baghdad, as Blair then saw it. Rosemary, it struck me reading the rest of that memo that, again, leaving aside the rights or wrongs, it was actually a pretty clear-headed analysis, wasn't it, of the potential pitfalls of what lay ahead?
Well, actually, I think they were counting on the Iraqis behaving differently. They were, as William Patey's alluded to, expecting of the Iraqis a willingness and propensity for democratic self-governance. And they had no plan to contain the borders of Iraq. Tony Blair is blaming the foreigners for stirring things up in Iraq, and certainly in the British sector in Basra. The Iranians were pretty quick to insert themselves into the scene there, and unfortunately British troops probably didn't know when they were listening to an Iranian as opposed to an Iraqi some of the time. So there was a kind of strange perception of what Iraq was. The Americans had it too. They thought you could change a regime in one country and the neighbours would keep out the way until you'd finished. They thought you could have free trade and open borders and there wouldn't be mass looting and smuggling and corruption. They thought they could pour in money and it would go directly into infrastructure projects as opposed to into people's pockets. It was an unrealistic assessment of the day after, even if the military plan and the removal of Saddam was okay.
William, it does mention, though, and this struck me as interesting, Blair talking about the WMD threat as a given. So that does seem to confirm that he genuinely believed the threat was real at the time. Does that exculpate him at all?
Well, it doesn't exculpate him from having proper planning and having a plan for the aftermath. I mean, I do think he genuinely did see Saddam as a threat, and history tells us he was. He'd used weapons of mass destruction on his own people. He had invaded the neighboring countries.
He saw him as evil, apparently.
There was a case. And I think Tony's problem was that he actually believed in the overthrow of the regime, but also knew that that wasn't a justification. You know, we do appreciate the rule of law, and he knew that unless there was a weapons of mass destruction case, regime change was not legal. So that's why perhaps he was forced into giving greater credence to the intelligence and to the failure of Saddam to comply with the inspectors who were there. I mean, that's all true. So it's not that he knew there were no weapons of mass destruction and went ahead anyway. I think he did believe it. And we all did, actually.
I mean, Rosemary had also said, and it struck me as something, well, it leapt out at me at least, where Blair writes to Bush that in Britain right now, I couldn't be sure of support from Parliament, party, public, or even some of the cabinet. Does that at least reinforce Blair's claim, and again, aside from whether he was right or wrong, that this was a genuine decision of principle on his part, that he didn't think that this would be a popular gambit?
Well, you're sort of inviting me to speculate about the character of Tony Blair.
That's exactly what I'm doing.
And I think, for goodness sake, a former cabinet minister, David Owen, who has a medical doctor's qualification, has written a book about hubris in power and takes Bush and Blair as two prime cases where, you know, so much power interferes with the judgment of the person concerned. It doesn't always happen, but he would not be the only one to also say that once a senior figure, especially a prime minister, has made the decision to use the armed forces to achieve a policy objective abroad, which was the case with Tony Blair in 1998 in Iraq, and he'd also had Sierra Leone and he'd had Kosovo under his belt, overweening confidence in his own judgment and what was the correct reading of the needs of the situation in terms of an objective, as opposed to the needs of the mechanisms that would have to work according to plan to deliver on the objective.
I mean, he did believe he was right. He believed in what he was doing, and as a leader, I think he felt the right to bring other people along with him. And in that memo, he's clear that he doesn't have the support. But as a leader, he thinks his job is to lead and to bring other people with him. And there was a vote in Parliament. The cabinet did agree. The idea that it's only him is a bit fanciful.
Okay, well, finally tonight, whatever the rights and wrongs of what Tony Blair and other holders of high Western offices did or said or thought in 2003, it is unarguable that the subsequent 13 years have been an agony for Iraq, as evinced by 250 further fatalities in last Sunday's suicide bombing in Baghdad, and by the fact that global reaction was surprised only slightly and only by the scale. Chilcot's best guess was that by 2009, 150,000 Iraqis had died and a million more displaced. William, you saw it up close for a period there. Is there any reason at all for Iraqis not to be still incandescently furious?
Well, they can be incandescently furious, but of course they've spent the last 10 years fighting amongst themselves as well. I mean, I was there at the time when the constitution was being debated, and I got rather frustrated in the absence of national leaders, because what you had was a bunch of factions manipulating the political scene to their own benefit. So whether you were Kurds or Shias or Sunni, there were very few national leaders, and that may be the reality in Iraq. You know, we're trying to preserve a country that has lost its meaning and purpose, and maybe Iraq is finished. I think probably it is. I think as a unified country, and I think the Iraqis themselves haven't played a great game here.
I mean, Rosemary, do you think that's fair?
I wonder if I could squeeze in here, because I heard the Prime Minister, David Cameron, talking about how he'd put in place mechanisms, including the National Security Council, to make sure that these gross misjudgments and failures are not repeated. And yet, if you look at the toppling of Gaddafi in Libya, exactly the same fallout was the problem, that you could not expect. It looked feasible for a short period of time in both Iraq and Libya that the local people could get themselves together. They were full of ideals. But I think we should have learnt by now that even by invasion and occupation, the British, with or without the Americans, can't do regime change and nation building successfully.
Well, I disagree with Rosemary there on the Libya example, because the very intervention was nothing to do with the regime change. It was to stop Gaddafi using his tanks to repress a rebellion. So in the end, we tilted the scales in favour of one side over the other. I don't think we took responsibility for Libya. There's a big difference between invading.
And we should have done.
Well, so we should have sent troops there to invade it.
We should not have gone in the first place. It was perfectly possible under international law to work out the consequences of military intervention to stop one of the objectives of the regime in place without thinking through, and then what?
Because that's what we've done in Syria. We've allowed the Assad regime to use all its means and force to repress its own people. In Libya, we decided to tilt the scales in favour of the opposition.
And we're not good at either, are we?
No, we're not good at any. I think that's going to be part of the legacy of Iraq.
Well, exactly that. Is there a point there, Rosemary, that part of the legacy of Iraq, that even when intervention is right and necessary and workable, if those circumstances should ever arise, that the Western world will shy away from them because it will just hear this voice screaming Iraq, Iraq, Iraq in its head?
Well, I would dispute that it's workable in any of these cases because of these sort of, I have to say, neo-imperialist assumptions that we can sort out people who can't sort out themselves. And I think that's the mistake.
Isn't neo-imperialist, though, to assume, just to bring up that point that William was making, that Iraqis shouldn't themselves take some responsibility for what's happened in the last 10 years?
Well, yeah, I think that's what I'm trying to say. And I was against intervention in Syria and remain so because with the experience of both Iraq and Libya, one being intervention heavy and the other being intervention light, that we do not have the capacity to make it better for the Syrians. And yet we convince ourselves, had we intervened, it would have been better for the Syrians. I don't think that is necessarily true.
There is a kind of isolationist case there that Rosemary makes. We should just stay out of it and let events take their course. I fear that's what will happen, because I think we've discovered in Iraq and my experience in Afghanistan is it is too difficult. I think we're not very good at it. So I think we could reach a point where we just don't play any role and we leave countries to their own devices. It'll be interesting to see if they turn out any better.
After Brexit, we won't have much capacity.
Yeah, well,
I mean, just a very, very brief thought from either of you. I mean, Rosemary, I'll ask you first, and I mean really brief, like 10 words or under. Are you broadly optimistic at all about the future of Iraq?
I think a reconfiguration of the map is happening, and the sooner we are prepared to live with that, the quicker we'll get to something better than where we are now.
And William?
I'm not at all optimistic, but I think Rosemary's right. The only solution is going to be a different configuration in Iraq.
Okay, well, on that note, we must leave it. Rosemary Hollis and Sir William Patey, who I've just realised I have been depriving of his knighthood while we've been on air. Apologies for that. Thank you both very much for joining us here on Midori House. That is all we have time for on today's programme. It was produced produced by Ben Ryland, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Patrick Hahn. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. There's more music next at 1900. It's The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli, and we'll have more on the Chilcot Report and the day's other main stories on the Daily at 2200. I'll also be your host for that. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.